The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. As usual, my name is Kingsley Kipuri, and we're going to be spending some time together for the next hour. Joined as usual as by my co-host Greg Nicholson, whose eyes are glued to the cricket that's going on right now. Greg, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad. I'm better than it looks for New Zealand at the moment.
Man, what a great line. I don't know anything about cricket, but it looks like, yeah, 31-4, two innings, target 400. I think that's average.
You're just reading numbers off the screen.
By global standards, I'd say that's well within, you know, the data we'd expect over the past 5 to 10 years, the last quarter. Okay, that's pretty good to go. Also loving the weather today. I'm in shorts. I feel incredible. Long may this weather continue. I mean, we have a lot of sort of political stories in the country and so on that can make things feel pretty gloomy. So if nothing else, the weather is wonderful. At least it is here in Joburg. So, you know, the happiest of cats. A lot of what we've been discussing, Greg, sort of came out of nowhere. So our eyes have been like focused on the elections. The local elections have wrapped up recently, and our eyes have been focused on what's going on with the Treasury, what's going on with the president. And out of nowhere over the past couple of days, or seemingly out of nowhere, came these protests from school in Pretoria. And we see these images of what appear to be young girls, you know, between, you know, 13, 14, 15. We see a police presence, and it's, you know, what's going on? So I know you went over to Pretoria yesterday, and I'd love you to just give us a timeline of what's going on over there.
Yeah, black students at Pretoria, Pretoria High School for Girls, have cited long-standing grievances over race issues and claims of racism and black students being, I guess, isolated and targeted for the way they look, their culture, their language, and they cite examples of favoritism towards white students and a sort of forced assimilation to the school's ostensibly white culture and history. And things, I think, sort of came to a head. Okay. Things came to a head recently when at the school there were certain instances, I think it was last week, and then they really escalated and led to some of these girls actually standing up and protesting on Saturday at their spring fair.
I mean, it's like I said, it seemed to be out of nowhere, but the second this happened, we saw a lot of response from alumni, current students, former students, not only of this school, but other schools, saying that what they're hearing and what we're hearing is not, it's not news, it's not new. So to talk us through this, we have Sinazo Magatlele, who's a former Pretoria Girls student, and she matriculated quite recently, matriculated in 2015, to give us some more context. Sinazo, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank
you. Wonderful. So, Sinazo, I mean, you heard me just talking to Greg and trying to figure out, you know, what's going on, what seems to be a surprise for some of us who haven't attended some of these institutions. So I'd love if you could just give us, you know, and really, you know, your experience. What was your experience of attending Pretoria Girls High? What is your experience as a black student, as a black woman in that environment?
Okay. I think I'll sort of start off by saying that I went to Pretoria High School for Girls from 2011 until 2015 when I matriculated. And I think that if you kind of look at the school's mission statement, the school founded in 1902, and Edith Aitken basically talks about kind of multiculturalism and diversity and bringing up well-rounded young ladies. And I think during my time at Girls High, I suppose in hindsight, looking back at it, it's kind of showing me how there were, I suppose, a lot of instances where Aitken's vision was probably undermined. And I think I'll start with, I think it was in 2013 or 2012, where one of the white head girls basically addressed him. So we have assembly and the teachers leave and we're addressed by the head girl. And the head girl basically addressing black girls and said to us that our hair was static and that she basically wanted us to tie our hair up and put our hair kind of to meet in our hair up. And all of this is basically grounded. The school has a code of conduct which has since been suspended, basically that has strict rules about dreadlocks and afros and braids, and our braids have to be, I think it's a maximum of 1 centimeter in width. And I know some of my friends telling me specifically that they've had teachers walking around with rulers measuring the width of someone's braid. There's strict rules about kind of hair color and your hair. If you have braids, your braids have to match your natural hair color, and kind of basically strict policing of hair in general, but more specifically black girls' hair, and making sure that you stipulate every kind of what kind of hairstyles we can have and restrictions and requirements on those hairstyles. And basically, whenever you talk about the code of conduct, we're forced to sign that every single year. And if you don't sign it, there are repercussions. And in terms of and whenever we kind of say anything about, but hang on, why is this there? It's always, well, this is what is in the code of conduct, and you sign the code of conduct, so you have to adhere to those rules. And if you don't like those rules, then you know you can always go to another school. And I think the problem I think with schools of this nature is they kind of hide behind this idea of being a prestigious school. Mm. So the idea that you're very privileged and you're very lucky to come to the school, so you kind of just have to go along with all of the rules because, hey, at least you're not in a less kind of a disadvantaged school somewhere else. I think also moving on to kind of some issues and some stuff that I've experienced is when I was in grade 8 to 9, I was taught by a black teacher at the school, well, two black teachers, and kind of moving on, and once I moved away from those teachers and looking at kind of people around me and talking about these black teachers, there was always, if a girl said she was going to this teacher's class, it was always like, oh, she's a horrible teacher, or she doesn't know what she's doing. So there's been kind of several attacks on their accents with the other teacher. I'm not going to kind of name those subject names because I think that would make it really obvious, especially because there are very few black teachers at the school. And basically mocking these teachers and questioning their credibility to teach the subjects that they teach. And I mean, I was taught by these teachers. I did really well at school. I think for one of the subjects, about 90%. For the other one, I did really, really well. And that was literally because I was taught by those teachers, and I took down what those teachers were telling me, and I was able to kind of put that together and get good marks. So for me, the claim that somehow they don't know what they're doing or they're bad teachers, I think, is based purely on the color of their skin and the way that they speak, and the fact that some girls don't like the way in which they deal, that the teachers would conduct themselves in classes. We have certain teachers that are called in or called upon to basically tell black girls to calm down, or to, if there's ever a situation where black girls are kind of seem to kind of be a little bit unruly, you have black teacher called in to police that situation. There was another member of staff at the school who would make announcements, and there would be frequent mocking of her accent, and basically people not respecting her, not listening to her. And I mean, some of the comments that some of the girls would make, they felt confident to make them to their fellow to our teachers' colleagues, and nothing was ever done about that. There's never been an instance where girls have been brought into kind of a question and said, you can't speak to people like this, it's extremely disrespectful. So I think those are some of the experiences that I've kind of seen, and the idea that somehow expressing your identity, expressing blackness only works if you can do it in a certain way. Mm. I wasn't in the RCL, and I was never in any of the RCL, which are the Representative Council of Learner meetings, or a prefect, and I was told that whenever anyone brought kind of any suggestion, it was shut down, and that was kind of, well, we're basing all of this new tradition and neatness, and we have to make sure that we're adhering to the strict history of the school and upholding that. And then this idea that somehow the school's image or outside comes before the needs or the lack that exists within the school, and that those have to be sacrificed because, well, Girls High is this prestigious school, and so therefore we have to adhere to that.
Okay, sorry. Thanks, Inazo. I just wanted to ask, I mean, I'm hearing some feedback from people who just don't seem to understand what the fuss is about, and sort of their sort of stance is like, you know, offices have rules, you have to dress a certain way to go to, you know, a lot of formal workplaces. Schools generally have rules, you know, and most people who've been through formal schooling had to have some kind of rules. So the general feeling from some people is, what's the big deal? Rules are rules. If your hair has to be like that, that's how society works. So what is it about these rules that you feel was oppressive or discriminatory?
And so I think that it goes far beyond kind of the hair. I think that the hair is an example. I think that the idea, so I do law with this. I'm a first year student, and we had case law where I think it was the NEC for Education versus Calais, who basically took on, I think it was Durban Girls High School, for not allowing the daughter to wear a nose ring for religious purposes. And in that that ruling, the Constitutional Court basically found that a code of conduct can be taken away and can be deemed null and void if they're discriminatory. Mm. And I think basically my point with this is that policing of hair and making sure that people's hair looks a certain way, I think is a bit outdated. I don't think that someone's appearance or someone's hair has any bearing on their intelligence or how they carry themselves. I think that there's neatness, but I think that the whole idea of neatness is braiding afros can all be neat. I think that it's kind of Western standards of neatness, and this idea that somehow you need to police people's hair in order to control them or to have some kind of hold on them. And I think it goes deeper than that, because I think I was interacting with some other friends of mine. I was hearing stories of how girls were told that they would not be allowed to write exams, would not be able to carry on writing exams if their hair looked like that. I heard yesterday that there was a girl who was told that her hair looks like a bird's nest. And I think the issue here is that you're dealing with young girls. You're exposing them to harsh criticisms like this. What are you saying about their blackness? And I think that's an important point, about their dignity and about what it means to be a young black woman. I think that we've reached an age or a society where black women are finding voices and being able to speak up and say, hang on, I don't actually like this. And I think that with a lot of these schools, you feel like you have to give up part of your identity in order to fit in. And I think that that's a big problem. I think that if we're going to talk about multiculturalism and being diverse, then we need to embrace that. And I think we should try and stifle people and say, well, you know, you're not allowed to have your hair like this. I think that's a bit of a problem. And I think secondly, not only is it the hair, I think there's also been, I was speaking to some other friends of mine who were saying to me, who actually go to Girls High, that there was a girl who wrote about white privilege or dismantling whiteness, and she was called to the principal's office, or she was threatened with a disciplinary hearing. And I think it's this idea that somehow there's something wrong with being black, and that needs to be silenced. And the way in which that's going to be silenced is by using things like a code of conduct. I think that it needs to be looked at, the way in which kind of we have these schools engaging with people of different races. And I think it's more than just an issue of, okay, well, your surface level, your hair looks like this, your hair looks like that. I think it has a deeper meaning, and that it's important that these things are addressed.
So now, that's a wonderfully succinct summary of all the issues, I think. So thank you so much for chatting to us and for using your voice to represent some of the girls who are still at school.
Thank you. Can I just say that I'm an old girl of this one. I just want to, I suppose, deflect attention and kind of praise those ladies, the black girls at Pretoria High School for Girls, who have taken up the baton, I suppose, and decided that they want to move forward with this. Mm. I think that looking at kind of sentiments on Twitter, there is a lot of old girls are speaking out about this and saying, we didn't have the courage to do this when we were still in the school. So I think I just basically want to praise those girls once again and just echo my support for them and just say, thank you, ladies, and just well done to them. And especially to the matrix, because the matrix are writing prelims. I know they have their first exam today. And to have the bravery to tackle this head on at a critical time in their academic careers, I think is a huge sign of bravery. So I think as much as I thank you for your compliments, I think I just want to say thank you as well to the black ladies at Girls High, who have basically used this not only to raise issues at Girls High, but issues across so-called privileged schools or schools, and they have good names. So I think that a lot of the thank you or the praise needs to go to all of them. Thank you.
All right. Wonderful. Thanks, Sinazo. That was Sinazo Magalele, who's a former Pretoria Girls student, matriculated in 2015, who's, you know, doing a great job of really breaking down why this is not just about hair, and how a rule that can appear fair in that all the girls must adhere to him can be discriminatory, which I think speaks well to a lot of the questions of people saying, what's the big deal? It's just hair. What's the big deal? All schools have rules. Offices have rules, and so on. Next up, we'll be speaking to somebody who's done deeper research into this. That's Panasha Chigumazi, who's an author, scholar. We've had her on my previous show discussing her fiction book, Sweet Medicine. More pertinent to this discussion is that as part of the Ruth First Fellowship last year, she did a study into black students who've attended elite and historically white institutions, which is which is we feel quite central to the conversation we're having. What happens when black students who are not historically included in a lot of these institutions suddenly have access to them, and how do they interact with the structures and the cultures of these institutions? So we'll just be chatting to Panache. Panache, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, perfect. So Panache, my first question is just around your research. And I mean, we're hearing these conversations that are coming out and these protests that are coming out of Pretoria Girls High. And I'd love for you to tell us some of the responses you got from other people. It sounds like the feedback we're hearing around the rules at this one institution are not unique. This is not something that's happening in one particular school to a few particular girls. It sounds like, based on the conversations you are having, that this is a widely held feeling that there's a discomfort among a lot of black students in a lot of these formerly white institutions. Could you talk us through some of what came out of your research?
Sure. I mean, look, I think what is quite interesting is the way in which people respond to it, as if it's some sort of hearsay. As if we haven't been seeing this for a while. I'm yet to meet a black girl, black woman, who has not been policed in some way or other about their hair. So I would like to stress that schools are not unique. It's just that in other places, it might be a little bit more covert, the ways in which we are policed. And I'll talk a little bit about that later. But definitely the experience about that was speaking to just how school codes of conduct would have these sneaky little ways of sort of regimenting black hair in terms of, you know, the kind of rules that we're seeing right now, saying that, okay, you know, hair cannot be more than above five centimeters. You know, if it gets past a certain length, it must be tied up and that kind of thing. But again, that's not really taking into account how black hair grows. So there's an assumption of what is neat. And what is neat is not the coarse sort of what we would call Afro-textured hair that black people have. There's the ideal form of sort of, you know, hair that can be put into a bun, which is not necessarily, or in most cases, is not black people's hair. So I think it's quite, if you had to just sit at go to a table at a restaurant and ask, well, what are your experiences with hair? I'm sure everybody would have horror stories about this. So it's also quite amusing to see how people are sort of gasping about this, as if we all didn't know. It's quite interesting because it's almost as common as, for example, schools regimenting skirt length and that kind of thing, which is just part and parcel of being a black body in a historically white school.
I find it interesting that you mentioned these horror stories, and the question I'm asking is, of course, quite central to your research, in that a lot of the people in the institutions we're mentioning on paper have a really great opportunity, right? So these are good educational institutions. So one can make a lot of assumptions around the kind of grades you will get, the kind of university you will go to, or the kind of access you have. Mm-hmm. So why does a person who has that kind of opportunity to be a Pretoria Girls alum and fit in and be head girl and all those things, why would that person revolt and make waves in that kind of institution rather than cling to it and sort of claim that opportunity?
And so just to clarify, the question is, why revolt? Why not just keep quiet about it?
Yeah.
Given the sort of opportunity.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we're saying it's not good enough that, you know, we have to hide and conceal who we are in order to be part of these spaces. I mean, the spaces in and of themselves are very problematic because there's a particular way in which we are made to conform to a particular standard. So a lot of these schools, whether it's the Afrikaans schools or the English schools, it's particular standards of whiteness. And that's not just across hair. It's ideas of, you know, what is, good English, what accents are acceptable, what kind of school songs and traditions we have. There are definitely schools that have continued really from the day pre-1994 days right up until now. So really the assumption of us being able to be in those spaces is on the basis, or rather the conditions for us to be in those spaces is the ability to assimilate. And I guess that would really differ from person to person, whether assimilation is something worth doing. For me, it's not. I come from, or I'm interested in, the black consciousness, and for me, it's simply not acceptable. ideally for me, we would have to start a new school completely, that's from first principle center blackness.
Mm.
However, I also do think that it's important that these institutions are made to change because they've been subsidized historically by Bunge Education. We know the kind of discrepancies that were spent on white school children's education versus on black children's education. So that infrastructure was really subsidized by the inferior education that black people have. So therefore, we have every right to be in those institutions, and every right for those institutions to reflect us as a majority black country.
So you're not buying this idea of that, if you're not fitting in, or if you don't like this school, you can just go to another one that suits you better?
No, I mean, that's incredibly anti-black, you know, because first of all, the resources to go and, you know, create a new school and to go somewhere else is not something that many black people have. So it's not, I mean, I went to a school that was started by a group of white parents who were not happy with the standard of education there. But, you know, that kind of thing requires institutional and generational wealth that most black people don't have access to. So the idea that you should simply go somewhere else is simply saying we should cede space to racists. That infrastructure was built and subsidized by inferior black education, as much as infrastructure in South Africa is. So the argument that in South Africa, I should simply go to another school is not even one that I want to entertain.
Okay. I suppose the last question is the sort of the wider one, the bigger one that everybody's now trying to contemplate of sort of a, what do we do now? Because, I mean, a big part of the South Africa sort of liberation project and democracy was to give people access to places where they were excluded. It's saying now you have the right to be here. The Constitution guarantees your right to be here. But now we're seeing that that access isn't enough. It's not enough to open a door and say, hey, you can now be here. So what?
Yeah.
So it's sort of a question around what is that next thing that we're not getting right that's beyond access?
Once again, so access is part of a project of simply, you know, assimilating what we call maybe an as black and fair model. You know, so again, on the basis that we can conform to standards of whiteness. So these schools need a fundamental, I hate to use the word transformation, it's called a decolonization, needs to be happening at primary and high school. Yes, it makes us feel better when a minister or MEC decides they're going to go there by case-by-case basis, but frankly, it's not good enough. These things don't happen in a vacuum. So it needs to be a complete overhaul of the education system. It's talking about curriculum. It's talking about school songs. It's talking about uniforms. So many things need to change, and the hair issue is really just one symptom of broader issues that plagued the education system that was inherited from the apartheid government.
Okay. I know I said that was my last question, but I suppose there is one more that I had forgotten about. Just around what, and this completely anecdotal way, it seems to be that there's a lot of young black people, a lot of young black women in different spaces that are questioning a lot of things that other people might, or like I did earlier in the show, see as a privilege or see as a great benefit. So sort of access to university and now, for example, access to this elite high school. Are you getting the sense that there's some kind of awakening amongst a lot of middle class young black people, or does there seem to be sort of a rise or awakening or awokeness that's picking up in a bunch of different areas, or is that just me reading social media?
I do think so. I think to use a school metaphor, I think we've got the report card for the Rainbow Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing, it doesn't work. We tried the experiment and it doesn't work. And this is not to say, there's been people who've been speaking out against the Rainbow Nation right from the beginning.
Mm.
For example, the PAC
yep.
did not join into Kudesa because of, you know, there's no land, no negotiation. So there's been people who've been able to see that, and many of us in the school, we did try and speak out, but also it was not the kind of thing that was going to go viral or was going to get support. So we're definitely in a different era where you can say things, you can question in a way that you couldn't do before. I do think that it is worrying, though, that we tend to focus on the things that happen in spaces where black people are in close proximity to whiteness and white people, so the more middle-class spaces. And what I mean by that is the fact that here in a Model C school, we have young black women who have protested, and we've rallied rightly so behind them. But yet, you know, last year there were many protests by the students of Philippi in the Western Cape And there was not much support. They were protesting against the inferior conditions of education that they're receiving there from the DA-ruled government in the Western Cape. Mm. So that's not something we wanted to protest because that was a majority black school. So I do think that we have been seeing, just like with the universities, we have been seeing protests in predominantly black and historically black areas, but those don't seem to be as interesting to us or don't seem to be as emotional for us as the ones when they're in white spaces. So I think it's just that the sort of awakening that the South Africa does not work for black people is finally moving on to the black middle class. And we're happy. It's important that this happens. But I also think that we need to also take stock of the fact that people have been protesting. And we need to really understand why it is that we find it easier to support a child at Pretoria Girls High, and yet we will keep quiet about a child at Philippines.
Okay. Can't put it much better than that. Panache, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, perfect. If you're just tuning in, that was Panache Chigumadzi, who's an author and who conducted research into the experience of black students who've attended historically elite and white institutions. Just lastly, we got a message via WeChat from Triple B, that I'll say, and just sharing their experience of matriculating in 2003 from Highlands North Boys High and having an experience where a teacher in front of the whole class said that this person should go to the toilet and wash their hair and undo their dreads because it looks like cheese curls. So not only insulting hair that's in its, you know, and it's growing in its natural state, but making an example. And it just echoes what is in Greg's great article from this morning and what we're hearing from Pretoria Girls High School and from a lot of people around the country. This is commonplace, the use of the code of conduct and the use of that intimidation by students and a lot of these institutions, by teachers, sorry, to make a lot of black students feel very uncomfortable about their natural state. Okay. Now, just to change gear somewhat to look at more regional issues. Starting off from here, we're just going back to 2011, where after decades of international diplomacy, including the UN and African leaders and a major influence from countries such as the United States and nowhere in the UK, a new country was created at South Sudan. And this was created with a lot of hope and optimism and envisioned as a very sort of neat split between the traditionally Arabic and Islamic north and the largely Christian south, with the assumption that the split of those down the middle would make everything better, so to speak. Anyone who's been following the situation somewhat over the past 5 years would comment and say that that's not worked out quite as planned. There's been a lot of violence, there's been a lot of unrest, there's been a lot of death, a lot of displacement, a lot of insecurity. And all that hope and optimism is, you know, scarcely to be found in the South Sudan project, so to speak. So this is a country that turned 5 in July, so a 5-year anniversary of that great moment of hope and optimism. And for that, we're talking to two individuals. That's Justin Lynch, who's an editorial fellow at the New American Foundation, who's worked extensively in South Sudan. And secondly is Jock Madut Jock, who's a co-founder of the Sud Institute and is an analyst on security, governance, democracy, and development in Sudan and South Sudan. So we'll just be talking through the great optimism and the project that was started through South Sudan and how that has played out since. Okay. Justin, I'd just love to start with you. If you could just take us back to 2011, when things went wrong sort of very quickly. Could you talk us through some of the key assumptions that the South Sudan project, so to speak, was based on and where those started to fall apart?
Sure. Well, I think there were three big reasons why the country really fell into the trouble that we have seen today. The first one is that when it became independent in 2011, it really didn't have the institutions that gave it the ability to govern effectively. There aren't things like a postal service here. There right now isn't power in many parts of the country. It runs on generators. So I think that those everyday services that most governments have didn't really exist when it became independent. The second one was corruption. I think this has been called one of the most corrupt states, perhaps, in the world, and I think that we continue to see it today. Many groups say that the elite rulers of this country continue to get a significant portion of the money that comes in. And I think the third big reason why we have seen South Sudan fall into the state that we have seen it today is the dramatic fall in the price of oil. South Sudan's government is almost exclusively reliant on oil. It has two big oil fields. And when the price of oil dropped in 2012, the country lost almost all of its revenue. It dropped from over $100 a barrel to below 40. And so that has really become a death wish almost for the country. And so all these services that were being funded through this oil couldn't continue. And so I think it was those three reasons why this country not really take off when it gained independence in 2012.
Okay.
And 2011, sorry. That's fine. 2011.
Jock, just turning to you, are there key things that in retrospect, and you look back to the 2011 constitution and the raising of the flag and that great excitement, are there key things that you think the international community really missed when they were setting up this new nation?
Yes, certainly. The most obvious would be the fact that so many horrendous episodes of violence that had taken place between South Sudanese themselves during the Liberation War, all of which the justice for these actions was postponed in order to keep everybody's attention on the main prize, which is to gain independence, in hope that when such independence is attained, there would be a revisit to those issues so that justice is done and reconciliation is achieved between the various communities throughout South Sudan, so that every citizen would feel that they have a stake in the country. These were not done. No reconciliation effectively was carried out, and no effort to offer any kind of recompense to these various communities. So everybody remained aggrieved, and when the conflict erupted, everybody responded to that conflict with that history in mind. That is one. The second is that the country embarked on state building, and the international community put all its weight behind that effort to build the institutions of the state, which was a kind of a vertical approach to building South Sudan. But the other side of the coin, which was missed, is a kind of a horizontal effort to try to build a sense of collective nationhood among all South Sudanese, so that every citizen feels that they had a stake in the body politic. So nation building part of that effort, which is only one side of the coin from state building, did not take place. So the idea of getting South Sudanese to graduate from their citizenship in their tribes into citizenship in a nation was not achieved. And so most South Sudanese remain more closely and tightly loyal to their regional and ethnic background and not to a collective entity called South Sudan. And so when those things, issues that were raised just by the previous speaker, like corruption, like the lack of services, when all these things were happening, the lens through which they were seen was that of ethnic identity rather than of national identity.
Okay. Justin, turning back to you, a big story of a big theme of the story of South Sudan is centered around two people. That's the President Riek Machar, former first vice president, Riek Machar, and the President Salva Kiir. Is the fact that so much depends on, one might say, the incentives or the whims or the or the egos or the networks of just two people in a whole country? Is that an indictment of how the process was set up, that everything depends on the cooperation or lack of cooperation or motivation of these two centers of power?
I think that was certainly one of the issues that got us in trouble, the last peace deal, which was signed in August. It was almost exactly 1 year ago. It placed President Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar kind of at the center of the country's politics. Mm. And what we saw was Riek Machar didn't come back to the country for 8 months. And it really kind of held all of the government hostage. They couldn't really do any business, and they kept trying to negotiate and get him back to country. He would argue that there were reasons for that, but nonetheless, the international community was very, very frustrated because he didn't come back to the country. And this dynamic between President Kiir and Riek Machar, there was a lot of tension there. And of course, this erupted in July when there was fighting between their two armies in the capital. So I think what we're seeing now is a shift away from this plan to keep these two men at the center of these countries' politics. And I think what diplomats are very quietly trying to do is push Riek Machar aside, very subtly. They have said, diplomats have said that they would work with Tabang, who was controversially named as the leader of the SPLM-IO party. That was the party that Riek Machar was the leader of. And Tabang was also appointed as the first vice president. And so diplomats have said that they are going to work with this new leadership duo to try and create peace in the country. And like you said, to try and perhaps try a different option than placing these two men at the center of the country's politics.
And Jock, when you hear about this new plan and this kind of restructuring to have different centers of power, do you think that there's something there? And do you think there's enough incentive from the leaders either of the state or of what are being termed as rebel armies? Is there enough incentive from all these key parties to actually maintain peace in South Sudan?
Well, there is both incentive and pressure that would seem to compel these leaders to prioritize peace and reconciliation over more violence as a method to achieve political objectives. One of the pressures is the fact that the country is literally broke, and how much longer the country can continue to engage in this deadly conflict under these circumstances is questionable. So I think there is definitely a desire on the side of the leaders to want to work towards peace, because they cannot afford much longer this violent confrontation. The incentives also exist, and one of them is the fact that Taban Dengai, who is somebody who has been very ambitious for leadership for a long time, now has the opportunity to try to bring his ethnic group to rally behind him by distributing the portion of the political power that is in Juba, to distribute it equitably among all the different ethnic groups, subgroups of the Nuer community, so that everybody has a piece of the pie. And that would be the quickest way for him to render Riek Machar irrelevant and therefore reduce the likelihood of many followers of Riek who are currently aggrieved, prevent them from continuing to give loyalty and support to Riek Machar in case Riek Machar comes back with the intention to fight a war to regain his position. So I think there are opportunities and there are challenges that can be utilized by diplomats and donors and mediators and regional powers to nudge these leaders towards peaceful resolution of these conflicts.
For my next question, Justin, I'd actually like to hear from you based on your ties in Washington. And I'm curious if you still think the international community still has real influence. A lot of people are saying that these threats of arms embargoes and so on really don't hold as much weight as they used to. Do you still think the international community, and the United States in particular, still has the kind of influence they once wielded to bring about peace?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have always believed that the U.S. never has the influence that it kind of thinks it has. I think this is true. This is perhaps one of the big lessons of the Bush administration in its foreign policy, is that if the country's internal dynamics do not want something, then the U.S. can't force that to happen. And I think South Sudan is a classic example. We can go back to this August peace deal. Neither Riek Machar and President Kiir wanted to sign this. President Kiir was very explicit that he was pressured into it. Into this, he says that he was threatened to sign it, and when he did sign it, he included 16 reservations on the peace agreement. And so, in the past year, we've seen the international community, and particularly the United States, try and force President Kiir to do things that he does not want. And President Kiir has gotten his way, more or less. He has been able to circumvent parts of the agreement that he disagrees with, and he's been successful. But it's interesting, when you talk to diplomats in Washington, they kind of take the same approach. They still believe that they can use the embargo and the threat of pulling out humanitarian aid to try and coerce President Kiir. And that remains to be seen, but so far it certainly has not worked, and it's unclear exactly how that is going to work in the future.
I mean, clearly you're quite critical of the U.S. foreign policy on this, and I'm curious, is your sense, and is the sense of perhaps other journalists covering this, that this is similar to an Iraq situation, an Afghanistan of American ideals around what freedom is and what their role is in creating freedom, and that just being a complete disaster?
Well, I think it's not necessarily a criticism. You can talk to diplomats and they will say the same thing. Okay. Many diplomats, and when you talk to the former special envoy of Sudan and South Sudan from the United States, he gave a speech saying this same thing, in that, you know, it's not necessarily a criticism of the U.S. government, but that the U.S. government isn't the end-all, be-all in this omnipotent power. When, you know, a country and its leaders don't want something, whenever the U.S. tries to force this, we've seen how that has backfired. I think South Sudan is a case study of this. The internal dynamics of the country are taking it in an opposite direction than what the U.S. is trying to force it on. And the country has pushed back, and they have... And we've seen the limits of the U.S. trying to force things on countries. We see that here. We see this in Iraq, when we saw the Sunni uprising in 2007. And we see that also in Afghanistan, where the U.S. Tried to do another nation-building task, and the internal politics of Afghanistan were quite different. And so the real story is that the U.S. Is limited in what it can do.
Okay. Jock, just turning back to you, I mean, just building on what Justin has mentioned, what does, in your view, a truly homegrown and a truly inclusive sort of next step or near term look like? What are the key things you need to see over the, you know, short term, medium term, that you think is a great first step into the kind of long-term peace and stability we need to see in South Sudan?
Well, I think the coming of Taban Dengai on board seems to give indications that there is now an effort to come up with alternative approaches to what has been proposed by the international community in terms of economic development, in terms of peace and reconciliation, in terms of security arrangements. I think the major criticism of the government of South Sudan all along has been the absence of any kind of homegrown philosophy of peacemaking or development. And in fact, the absence of such a homegrown philosophy has left a playing field for the international community to suggest left and right. And some of the things that would not succeed, like the arms embargo, like the sanctions, like the intervention force, all of which would definitely fail if there is no cooperation with the host government. And so there are now indications that this is exactly what the government of national unity, the current one, with Thabang Dengai as first vice president, is trying to do, which is to propose these approaches, that this new approach is one of which will be to have a country's own program of action with regard to regaining the country, regaining its own footing economically, and this program of action would list some of the basic priorities that the country needs to deal with right now, including stabilizing the economy, increasing the level of security and safety of citizens, approaching the humanitarian challenges and needs from an internal perspective, as well as trying to revise some of the revenue sources, taxations, and rebuilding the oil fields that were destroyed in the war. And then once you have those priorities listed and very clear, you also list some of the financial resources available to tackle these priorities, and then produce a deficit, which the country will say that they cannot, they don't have the resources to meet these needs, and invite the any interested donor countries to contribute to that, which is a national plan and not a donor's plan. And if that was done, then the likelihood of a kind of international bailout would be increased. Perhaps bailout in the form of loans from IMF and from individual donor countries would be a lot more. It would be easier to accomplish and to achieve, rather than simply asking for help without objectives, without clear a plan of action.
Okay, thank you. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us. Justin Lynch, Jock Madu Jock, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, perfect. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for all the people who spoke to us and our guests, and for everybody listening in online. Remember, you can download and share the podcast. We'll see you next week, same time, same place.
This is CliffCentral.com.